The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Thank you very much. In my culture, there's a proverb that says, after the chief has spoken, you have nothing else to say. And I really kind of feel like that. That was absolutely, it was such an inspiring presentation. Thank you so much. I'd like to welcome you to the first panel discussion on the new convention, Process, Principles, and Prospects. My name is Charlotte McLean-Chapo. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to introduce each panelist before they speak very quickly, so that we have a lot more time for the substantive part of our discussion. And the first person to speak is Maria Veronica Arena. Maria is a very well-known advocate in the area of disability. She's also one of the people who's been at all of the sessions around the development of the convention. Maria is the director of an international programs at the Burton Black Institute, where she leads BBI's efforts to advance the agenda of people with disabilities worldwide and coordinates these efforts with BBI's domestic programs. And before joining BBI, she served as president of the Center of International Rehabilitation. And she has a very long resume, which I'm not going to read to you because it's before you. But what I'm going to do now is hand over to Maria so that she can make a presentation. I think we've each got 15 minutes. So over to you.
Yes, thank you, Charlotte. And thank you to the organizers for this very good event and opportunity to talk about the convention. I will talk to about three issues. And first of all, about the convention drafting process, as it was a very unprecedented process, which includes full participation of people with disabilities. And the second thing I wanted to talk to you very briefly is about the International Disability Caucus, that is an alliance of people with disabilities, organizations, and allies, that interacted together within the convention process framework. And the last thing is going to be about the achievement of the disability community within this convention. As we know, in 2001, the General Assembly resolution, established an ad hoc committee to consider proposals for a convention to protect the rights of people with disabilities. And in 2002, this committee had the first session and decided to seek views and suggestions on a convention by state and all relevant parties, including international and regional and national organizations, such as PAHO, WHO, etc. And they, after some very hard discussions about the participation of non-governmental organizations, the committee decided to allow the participation of disability and allies organizations within the discussions as observers. And we also had the opportunity to speak to the committee, to speak on the floor. They decided to meet again in 2003. In 2003, the committee had the second session and decided to proceed with the drafting of a convention. So also decided to establish a working group to prepare and present a draft text of a convention, which will be the basis of negotiation by member states. And this working group included 27 representatives of states that the regions selected among themselves, which countries will represent the region, and 12 NGOs, and one national human rights institution representative, and these discussions were led by a coordinator. And the disability community had fought very, very hard for the inclusion of people with disabilities in this working group. And representatives of the disability community were granted nearly one-third of the seats on the working group, which is unprecedented for an official UN drafting committee. In subsequent ad hoc committee meetings, the international disability community participated in various ways, but we could influence the drafting of the text by submitting draft of alternative convention text to the working text that the states were drafting during those meetings. And we make a statement before the committee in the plenary, and also we lobby all the delegations. We also have the opportunity to include people with disabilities as official members of the state delegation, and that was that interaction between the disability community and this disabled delegate was a very important tool for us to lobby the states. And now I want to talk to you briefly about the International Disability Caucus, that was this big coalition that interacted with the states during the convention negotiation. And this caucus has been the representative voice of persons with disabilities worldwide in this process. This caucus is composed by more than 70 worldwide, regional, and national DPOs, that means Disabled People's Organizations and Allies. And we all together decided to cooperate to get a good convention for everybody in this world. And I have some of my colleagues here that belong to the International Disability Caucus. It's Kina Minkovic, that's going to speak later, and Thomas Largebot, and Jerry White is there also, is part of the Disability Caucus. The Disability Caucus, since the beginning of this process, was open to all organizations of people with disabilities, as well as other organizations, for example, Save the Children, that wanted to cooperate in this process, and all these organizations recognize the leadership of disabled people's organization. And that was a very important principle for us to function, because historically, people with disabilities and their organization have been marginalized, and other people have made decisions on our behalf. So for this caucus to function, our principle was the leadership needs to belong to people with disabilities and their organizations. And our objective was to obtain this a convention which promotes the human rights of all people with disabilities, regardless our disability, the type of disability we have, and also the part of the world we live. That's why we try to organize our caucus in a way that where we include all people with disabilities around the world and with our own diversity, considering our own diversity. How we worked. We undertake intensive consultations among our members, and also we consult to our regional networks and national organizations to arrive at a common position in all on all issues. And during this convention negotiation, the caucus made decisions by consensus. And when an issue was exclusive to a specific group of people with disabilities, the organization that represent that group played a determining role in defining the IDC position. That was very important because we recognized the expertise of these disability groups. So we own the knowledge that is on us, about us. That was very important. And the position of the IDC were negotiated in a group discussion online. It was in a Yahoo group. It exists. And for us, email was very important vehicle because many of us cannot travel to New York. So we are very happy with the new technologies. Of course, they are not fully accessible, but we manage that. And also an important number of us could come to New York to the meetings. And we have everyday plenary sessions where we approve new text, alternative text that we drafted, exchange information, plan new advocacy actions, and make decisions about who was going to speak the next day at the plenary session. And that was very important also because we learned how to speak on behalf of Disability Caucus instead of speaking on behalf of our own organization. In the beginning, everyone wanted to speak at the plenary, and at the end we learned that we needed to speak with one voice and also show this unity to be able to achieve our goals. And I will briefly mention the IDC achievements. Ambassador Mackay, who was the coordinator of the working group and the last chair of the law committee, says that 70% of the convention is actually the IDC alternative text. I would say that it's 60%. we fought very hard for some text, and we got a wonderful convention with the help of the delegates. But I would like to underline some of them. We think that we have been chatting with Tina yesterday, trying to come together with some important points to raise today. Legal capacity, we feel that is one of our main achievements. The convention gendering, we have an article on women and also several dispositions, provisions on gender in several articles. The children article, the inclusion of sign language and Braille in the convention, reasonable accommodation, and is tied to discrimination. Situation of risk is another article that we consider IDC achievement. The education article. Several participation provisions throughout the convention, informed consent, and the right to integrity. And that is all I have to share today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. It's kind of hard to be passing notes around and saying to people 2 minutes. Now I'm going to ask you to do that to me when I speak.
Okay.
Because I have a tendency to kind of go on. I was asked to speak about some of the principles, and I have a PowerPoint presentation which has been circulated. I don't know if it's on the screen, but I'm just going to talk to it. And I just wanted to first of all present some background, and just to say that one of the important things that I think this convention does is that it advances the principles that are in the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, and that it builds on a lot of existing other structures and declarations. For instance, it builds on the World Program for Action. It builds on the standard rules for the equalization of opportunities for people with disabilities. And it also reflects and is very consistent with international human rights law and analogous disability law. For instance, the ADA. I mean, it has drawn heavily, in my view, from the ADA. And it also provides an overarching framework for the interpretation and the implementation of the rights that are entrenched in the actual text. It has 8 principles, and these principles really kind of run through all of the provisions that have been found in the specific articles. I think one of the most important principle is the principle of universality. And that's the principle that all international human rights instruments protect the human rights of all persons with disabilities. But clearly this hadn't worked for people with disabilities. And that's why it was necessary for us to make sure that we were able to have a convention that dealt specifically with issues related to people with disabilities. Another very important principle is the principle of respecting inherent dignity, individual autonomy, and ensuring that people are able to make decisions and make choices for themselves. Again, another important principle is the principle of non-discrimination. And this is not a new principle. It's a principle that has become part of customary international law. And actually, it was at the beginning of the discussions of this convention, it was the principle that many countries wanted to see as almost the only principle. There was a big move to have focus on non-discrimination. And for people with disabilities and for people working in the sector, we were saying that it had to be more than non-discrimination. It had to be linked to substantive equality because if it didn't have substantive equality, essentially we would have a convention that says you cannot discriminate, but it wouldn't give us the kind of the meat, you can see where I come from, the meat that is needed to make sure that people actually are able to enjoy this right. Another very important principle was the principle of full and effective participation and the inclusion into society. And then the respect for difference. I think that in terms of the arts, the principle of participation, it's a in this convention, it's couched as a principle, but it's also in the convention as an obligation, and it's also in the convention as a right. So there are almost three tiers of participation throughout the text of this convention. The other very important principles are equality of opportunity. And again, this was about ensuring that we level the playing fields for people with disabilities. It doesn't help to say that we will not discriminate if you do not provide opportunities that can facilitate equality. And then the issue around accessibility was was an important principle raised. And then I think a very important principle, and again, this had to do with the participation of the disabled people's organizations and particular thematic groups. And in this case was groups working with children and children with disabilities themselves, making sure that they were able to push for the issue around the respect for evolving capacities of children with disabilities. And again, I think that this was a really important principle that needed to find place in the convention. But I'm not going to speak to every single one of those eight guiding principles. I'm just going to pick out a few. And one that I think is obviously quite important is the principle of equality. And this to me is kind of the fundamental principle of the convention. And what it does essentially is that it guarantees that those similarly situated will be dealt equally by the government and the law. So it really ensures that you have equality before the law, which is an absolutely essential principle for people with disabilities. And I think it's also a principle that we all share. And one that really recognizes that people are equal and that nobody is less equal or more privileged than the other. And I think what it also does do, and I think particularly important in the area of disability, is that it says or can be construed to say that no disability, no matter how slight or how severe that disability is, you cannot discriminate. Equality is equality. Another very important principle is the principle of non-discrimination. And again, this is not a new principle. It's a principle that exists in all of human rights law and is found in all human rights conventions. But what this convention does do is it prohibits discrimination. And it goes further than just prohibiting discrimination. It prohibits discrimination both that's indirect and discrimination that's direct. And this is, again, a very important nuance for people with disabilities. Because, for instance, the indirect discrimination could be not being able to vote during election times because voting polls haven't been made accessible. And very often we don't think about that, but this is a kind of a very indirect way of discrimination, and I think it's very important that it's been addressed in this convention, because I think that it goes back to my point earlier on around ensuring that there is actual substantive equality in the text of the convention. And then I think very importantly, the principle of non-discrimination points to the fact that failure to provide reasonable accommodation can be seen or construed as a form of discrimination. Again, for people with disabilities, this is absolutely essential if we're serious about talking about leveling playing fields, if we're serious about talking about the opportunity of equality. The next, I think, very important principle is the principle of full participation. And as I said earlier on, there are three tiers of this in the convention, as a guiding principle, as an obligation, and as a right. Why so many times does it appear? Well, participation is very important. It's very important for people with disabilities. It's important that people with disabilities are able to engage in decision making, that they're taken seriously, that they're part of the decision making and not always just part of addressing the problem. So this becomes really important. It allows for the engagement, and it allows for people to ensure that in all processes of developing legislation or whatever it is, you have participation of people with disabilities. But now let me move on from the principles, because I think I've given you a sense of what the principles are. But principles are great, but we need to find ways to operationalize these principles. We need to find ways to make sure that these principles then become part of living law and become part of changing essentially the lives of people with disabilities, because this is what this convention is about. And so we need to find ways of moving these fundamental principles that, you know, will affect the lives of about 650 million people to ways that we can demonstrate them in terms of how they work in practice. And that then happens by looking, I'm going to try and do that by looking at a few concepts. And one of the most important concepts is that of, in my view, accessibility. And Article 9 speaks to that. And it's important just to mention here that it's the first time in an international human rights convention where the concept of accessibility has been mentioned. And I think here the point is, my little point here is, it's not just enough to bestow rights to people, but we need to make sure that people can feasibly enjoy these rights, and that you can actually find ways of making sure that the rights are tangible and that they're not just paper rights, as was said earlier on. Briefly, we've got different types of rights. And I think the important message here is to recognize that we're not talking about standards anymore. We're not talking declaration. We're not talking guidelines. We're not talking soft law. We're talking serious stuff. We've got a convention. It has provisions. It has obligations that are binding on state parties. And the kind of rights that are entrenched in this convention are civil and political, economic, social, and cultural. And they can be broken down into immediate rights. So, for instance, non-discrimination requires immediate redress, whereas you've got another set of rights, which are the social and economic rights, which are the rights that can accommodate the whole concept of progressive realization. Now, I just want to say that this is binding on state parties as far as we know. And this means for state parties, they need to ensure that they respect, protect, and promote, and very importantly, fulfill all of the rights that are contained in the cluster of both economic and social rights, as well as the civil and political rights. I'm really rushing now, but I have to mention Article 32, because it would be remiss of me if I did not. Article 32 is the article in the convention that speaks to international cooperation. And again, while the responsibility for the protection and the promotion of people with disabilities lies primarily on the states, it's really important for us to understand and to recognize that it doesn't just remain with the state, and that there are other players that have a responsibility. So international organizations have a responsibility to really become part of this process and to begin to look at how they mainstream the issue of disability in the development programs, as John had mentioned earlier on. And that means looking at inclusive design. It means looking at inclusive development. And so in conclusion, what does this convention do? This convention binds all actors to view persons with disabilities as subjects and not as objects. And for me, that is an absolutely huge, huge shift. And upon these principles and these guarantees rest the paradigm shift that will empower people with disabilities and strengthen the advancement of human rights for all. So we're not just talking about strengthening human rights for a particular section of our population. I see this convention as strengthening the rights for disabled people,
but really going beyond that and strengthening the whole body of human rights. And I really see it as a convention that will be remembered for engineering this decisive shift in the war of ideas and in the cause of humanity. And I know I've abused my power as chair. And just say that, you know, for me, the final rationale for the inclusion of people with disability is that it is no longer based on charity, but that we now have legally binding imperatives. And I'll stop there and move to the next speaker. And the next speaker is Stephen Hill. And Stephen is an attorney with the State Department Office of the Legal Advisor. And he was the head of the delegation to the UN at both the 7th and 8th sessions of the ad hoc committee. And Stephen has a JD from Yale Law School. Over to you.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much, Charlotte. And I will be brief, mindful of the time. It's a pleasure to be here, and I thank the organizers for making this event happen. It really is crucial. The last time I saw many of you here was after about 48 to 72 hours of being up all night as we were finalizing the negotiation of the convention. So it's nice to see a bunch of friendly faces, and it's also nice to see exposure given to this convention. I should clarify that I am, as Charlotte said, an attorney advisor in the Human Rights and Refugee Law section of the State Department's legal office. Our office is composed of six people. We're charged with the negotiation of human rights treaties generally. We're located in the State Department, so we're not specialists in disabilities issues. We're specialists in international human rights law issues, and particularly as those play out in the United Nations. The U.S. delegation was quite large. We probably had from 10 to 12 people there. I see that a number of our delegation members are present in the audience today. Dr. Peg Giannini from the Director of Disability at the Health and Human Services Department. We have Stephanie Ordoleva in the back, who is the Disabilities Coordinator for the State Department and plays a major role on the disabilities policy side within the State Department. We also had representatives from the Department of Justice, including John Wodach, whom many of you may know, and from other government departments as appropriate. We had transportation participate. We had different offices that provided the subject matter expertise as the negotiations went on. As I said, my office looks at the systemic issues involved in human rights treaties. Not only when they're negotiated in the UN system, but as they move forward in the domestic consideration process within the United States, which, as many of you know, is a very complicated process. I am speaking here today in my personal capacity, which should hopefully let me share some insights with you that we normally wouldn't necessarily speak about in the public view, but I think I am very familiar with the views of the administration on the treaty, and I can try to provide an explanation of that. Our role, let me talk about, first of all, what was the U.S. role in the convention negotiation process, and then secondly, what are our views about the treaty now, and then probably thirdly, which is an important concern to people here, why is it that we've taken the position that we do not intend to become a party to the treaty at this time? So first of all, and I thank Maria Veronica for the excellent overview of the process, what I always focus on in presentations, and in fact I said this at the final session of the ad hoc committee, and I think it's absolutely true, is that the United States strongly welcomed the process that led up to the negotiation of the convention. And we've, in fact, strongly welcomed the adoption of the convention. If you carefully look at the U.S. speech, both in the ad hoc committee that I made, but also that Ambassador Terry Miller in New York made when the General Assembly adopted the convention in December, You'll see that it starts off with the idea that the United States strongly welcomes the adoption of the convention. And I think that's a maybe for folks who are not as familiar with the UN speech on issues, to say that you strongly welcome something is a significant use of language in the UN. Welcomes is a strong word that has a great deal of meaning within the UN system. If you really didn't like something, you would definitely not within the UN. Welcome is a magic word within the UN. If you didn't like something, you would not say that you welcomed it. In the negotiations, the U.S. made a controversial announcement at the beginning of relatively near the beginning of the negotiations, that we didn't intend to become party to the treaty. And the reason that Assistant Attorney General Ralph Boyd, Civil Rights at the time, gave, and I think Governor Thornburg referenced it in his speech, was that the U.S. thought that the resources would better be spent by countries looking at their national legal frameworks and improving their national legal frameworks. That's sort of analogous to the U.S. experience with the various pieces of legislation, including the ADA, but it's also consistent with our international disabilities policy, which focuses on domestic capacity building in different countries. Now, I'll say that as the negotiations proceeded and it became clear, you know, in those days that was the beginning of a process. So as it became clear that this convention was going to become a reality, and as it became clear that really in terms of the principles that Charlotte laid out and that really are the principles that undergirded the whole discussions, and as it became clear that the DPOs and other NGOs were playing an extremely important role within the process that led up to it, of course our posture shifted, and I think evolved, I shouldn't say shifted, but evolved, to I would say a posture of very full engagement in the negotiation of the convention. You saw that, I think, not only in terms of the public speeches we made, which I think were very supportive of the kind of principles that Charlotte set forth, but also were extremely supportive of the role of DPOs. And in fact, mm-hmm. I always said to the folks in the delegation that we should every morning comb the voluminous proposals that the Disability Caucus came out with and wherever we could support something to support it as a matter of principle, because we strongly believed in the role of civil society organizations in this process. And it was a historic role. And it's a role that we actually hope will serve as a model going forward in other UN negotiations. This was an important process for us also in terms of agenda setting. The convention process, and this is an example of how the process itself had enormous value, quite apart from the document that resulted from it. The process of negotiation put disability issues on the agenda at the UN in a much more high-profile way. Let me just give you one example, because I'm already running up against my time limit. Accessibility issues in the UN building, I mean, this is more of an administrative or a construction issue. It became clear in the process that there were massive problems regarding that. I think some of you who are there will remember a really disastrous fire drill that we had. And I'll let you know that, there's a plan being developed right now for the master renovation of the UN headquarters in New York. And this issue was reported directly into that process, is going to be integrated into that master plan. So that's one example for you. Also, just in terms of the resolutions that we negotiate in the General Assembly at the Human Rights Council, disabilities issues are getting integrated or mainstreamed into those resolutions. So we had in Geneva 2 weeks ago an event on violence against children. And a number of states raised the issue of violence against children with disabilities as a sub-issue. And that's an example of, you know, the awareness raising that this convention process has represented. Also within the U.S. government, and I say this coming from the State Department, which isn't sort of an action agency, as it were, on domestic disabilities issues, within the U.S. government, the convention process, one of its byproducts, was really to help us coordinate what we were doing better. And so one of the important issues in the negotiations, as Charlotte said, was the issue of international cooperation. We knew that we were doing a lot in the area of foreign assistance with regard to disabilities. We knew that we could do a lot more. But one thing that we realized as we were preparing for the negotiations is we didn't actually have a full compendium of what all of those programs were in a handy place. And so we were able to put that together through the negotiation process. Our various advisory committees at the State Department, I'm glad to see that we have some of our members here, Kathy and others, have been discussing the issue of integrating the convention-type principles into our programs, and I think that's something that'll go forward. Also, within the context, and I don't want to really speak for USAID directly, but I do note that I have a colleague here, Anne Hayes from USAID. I know that USAID is moving forward strongly with its policy of integrating disability issues into development programs, and that this process is something definitely that's being spurred by the convention. Not only for, I mean, the practical reason, if you're doing programs in a country that's a state party to the convention, those programs have got to comply with the convention. Let me just say a word quickly about the issue of becoming a party to the convention, signing or ratifying the convention. As many of you may know, and here I'm talking more from the perspective of international human rights law, the U.S. Does have I can say, unusual or unique relationship with international human rights treaties compared to other countries. Unlike a lot of the other Western democracies, the U.S. is not party to all of the core human rights treaties. We're only a party to three of the six major existing human rights treaties. And I don't think this is because we have something problem with human rights, but it has to do with our domestic legal system and the long processes that go into ratifying a human rights treaty. First of all, the issue of advice and consent of the Senate. And also it has to do with the degree to which we, as an executive branch, want to assure ourselves that we're fully capable of implementing every single provision of the treaty before signing up to it. Before the U.S. becomes party to a treaty, we conduct an extremely extensive review of U.S. law, and that's not only in the federal area, which actually, if this convention was purely kind of ADA-type things, provisions, it would be a lot easier because we look at federal, but this convention, especially in the legal capacity area, touches on things that are state law. And we have to be sure, because it's the federal government that's responsible for implementing the convention on the international level, and there is monitoring, et cetera, that the state law is consistent with the convention. Our practice is also not to actually become party to the convention until we've got all the domestic pieces in order. In that regard, the U.S. is very much unlike other countries who tend to, I think as Governor Thornburg was saying, use conventions as a way to pull themselves up, to pull their domestic legal orders up to an international standard. The U.S. tends to take the other approach. But I do have to say that the decision, and one, it's very early in the process. Second, the decision not to become a party at this time was not a decision that was based on a disrespect for or disregard or devaluation of the process. In fact, the U.S. greatly valued the process. It's based, at this point, and I'm glad to go into it in questions, on really our human rights treaty policy generally, which is really to ensure that where we do undertake obligations, they're done in, we're absolutely sure that we can do so in a 100% manner. And that's not to say that the absolute bulk of the convention isn't very consistent with the way we do things in the U.S. That's not to say that we don't like many of the things that are in there, but it is a complicated process. In any event, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Stephen. I'm going to ask Tara to now make a short presentation for 15 minutes and hopefully have a bit of time at the end of that for questions. Tara is a human rights attorney specializing in the legal protection of economic, social, cultural rights. And she played a very active role in the drafting process in New York. She's also a Yale Law School graduate, and the rest of her bio is in here, so over to you, Tara.
Great, thank you very much. It's a great pleasure for me to be here on this panel and in this room today with so many of the people who played such a truly instrumental.
Great, is that better? Great. It's a great pleasure for me to be here today on this panel and in this room with so many of the people who played a really truly instrumental role in the shaping of the text and the commitments in the Disability Convention. But as so many of us realize, despite all of the tremendous work over the last 5 years, it's really just now that the real work has to begin. the work of translating the broad commitments that are established in the convention into practice, into our local communities, into our local work, into local legislation, into local ordinances. This is what our job is now, and we have a long road ahead of us. And I think that's something important to put right out front from the beginning. As Governor Thornburg said, this is a long process. It will take a long time, but that process has to begin. I want to focus here on some of the implementation mechanisms that are envisioned in the convention. And I think later today in our strategy session, we're going to focus on some of these, thinking very creatively about where do we go from here? How do we actually make these broad guarantees real for our communities? And in that sense, I think it's important to start out with just a couple of basic points. One, that internet human rights treaty law is not only about what governments have to do. Governments ratify treaties and they undertake commitments under them. And then we often think, well, then it's the government's responsibility to implement it. It's not. It's all of our responsibility to implement the convention. This has to be taken on as a national project in which each one of us is committed to implementing these guarantees in all of the areas in which we work. And in this sense, the convention really takes this into account. In its general obligation clause, it specifically recognizes that states' parties shall closely consult with and actively involve persons with disabilities in the development and implementation of legislation and policies to implement the convention. Also, in the implementing mechanisms that are envisioned in Article 33, they also recognize specifically the importance of the role of civil society and persons with disabilities in monitoring government achievements and progress. This is something that we need to embrace as part of this process. Also, in responding to Steve's comments, and in taking this on as a national project, we can start to do that, and we can start looking at our national legislation to see whether we are in fact going to ratify once we sign. And I think that's a first step that the country could take on very easily, as we have with many other conventions. Many of the other human rights conventions that the United States has ratified were signed a very long time ago, and then there was a long process that went into deciding whether to ratify. But let's push for the first step for the State Department to pressure the executive to sign this treaty, and then we'll work from there toward ratification. There are two kind of major sets of implementing mechanisms envisioned in the convention, one in terms of national monitoring and implementation, and the other international supervision and monitoring. The national implementation mechanisms are where we can really be creative. That's where we can work. We can decide how we're going to implement this convention in our own country, in our own ways, in ways that really make sense for ourselves. And the convention is very explicit on that the different forms of implementation will be different in every country, because they have different forms of administrative law, different ways of structuring government. We need to do what makes sense for us. And in this sense, the convention very broadly lays out a structure. And it says that each state shall designate one or more focal points. There's a set of focal points, there's a coordination mechanism, and then there's a framework structure for implementation. So at the focal point is essentially somewhere where everybody knows that this is the person who is the contact person for all disability convention-related activities. We want to recognize who that person is so we know who to go to, who to bring complaints or issues to, who is the ultimate, not the ultimate responsible person, but the person that we know to go to. That can be somebody at the national level. It could also include one person at each state level. So we have a national focal point and then a focal point at the state level for all 50 states. Then a coordination mechanism. There should be some sort of a coordination mechanism under the understanding that one person can't implement or even one agency can't implement the convention. There has to be coordination between all branches of government, all agencies and departments within the executive, and then going down into the state and local levels. There has to be some mechanism of coordination there. And it's important to recognize in that sense that there actually is a formal framework set up in the U.S. government for such coordination. It was initially envisioned by an executive order issued by President Clinton back in 1998, which created an interagency working group for human rights treaties. And the idea was to have a coordination mechanism within the executive branch to make sure that the entire government was working together to ensure our commitments under the human rights treaties that we have in fact ratified. At that time, it was the Torture Convention, the Convention on Civil and Political Rights, and the Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. We have since then ratified additional treaties such as the Optional Protocols to the Convention on the Rights of the Child. Although we haven't ratified the Convention on the Rights of the Child itself. But this mechanism formally exists. We need to work to reinvigorate it, to infuse resources, to make it actually function. And it is specifically given the mandate to create education, human rights education programs in sectors throughout the government to respond to individual complaints of human rights abuse, to prepare periodic reports to the international agencies, to do a periodic review of legislation or of proposed legislation to make sure it conforms to our international treaty commitments, and also to look at the complaints that come in to see whether changes need to be made in our own legislation to ensure that we are, in fact, in conformity with our international human rights commitments. So this framework exists. Under the Bush administration, it has been reconstituted into something else. It's called something different. It's called a Policy Coordination Committee. But the functions remain. So we need to think about all of these different possibilities out there and how we can make them actually work in support of the Disability Convention. The third level is to have a framework for protecting and promoting and implementing the convention. And in this sense, all of this is laid out in Article 33, although in very concise language, but this is really what it's saying. And in Article 33.2, it requires states to maintain, strengthen, designate, or establish a framework including one or more independent mechanisms to promote, protect, and monitor implementation of the convention. This will often take the, in many countries, it will take the form of a national human rights institution or a human rights commission that will take on the primary role of, for example, receiving complaints from people at the local level. Working to create awareness at the local level. Many of our cities around the country have human rights committees or commissions. Let's make these work for the Disability Convention. Let's create a real framework for promoting human rights and the human rights that are recognized in the Disability Convention. So if we have our focal point, our coordination mechanism, and our framework, and we can work on these things together. I hope we can spend some of the time in the afternoon talking about some strategies and how we can link up with some of the work that groups working on other human rights treaties, such as the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, are doing a lot of work at the local level to try to implement these conventions at the local level because we haven't actually ratified the treaty at the federal level. And so we need to work, if we're not going to incorporate downward, we need to incorporate upward. So all of this, everything that we talk about in terms of implementation, we need to go forward with whether or not the United States ratifies. There are so many things that we can do to enforce these provisions without actual ratification, and that has been shown to be true in terms of the work that's being done under the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women and the Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, for example. There's a lot of work being done, and we need to work with the many different groups that are focused on these issues around the country. Briefly, I want to look at some of the international supervisory mechanisms. There will be a committee on the rights of persons with disabilities established under the convention. That will be a committee made up of 12 experts who have recognized competence in the field of disability and human rights that will be nominated and elected by the state's parties to the convention. They will have a periodic reporting procedure that they will monitor, whereby states will prepare reports on the measures that they have taken to fulfill each one of the guarantees in the convention, and also on the progress made in achieving these rights on the ground. The U.S. currently participates in this procedure under three international human rights treaties. It would not be difficult for the U.S. to participate in another. And the U.S. has consistently recognized in participating in this process with regard to other treaties that it's a very useful process for the United States in terms of looking to see exactly where we are in terms of human rights achievement. That's what we want to do with the Disability Convention as well. We want to have a good sense of where we are to be able to project where we want to go and then come up with real effective strategies to get us there. That's what the whole process is about. That's what the international supervisory system is about. It's a process system designed to make sure that we're doing the right things locally. And that's something that we should always keep in mind. As Steve was saying, the United States is very committed to working with civil society groups at the domestic level. That's what we want to do as well. We want to work at the domestic level. We're going to use these international principles and our human rights law in order to get us there to guide our own work. But what we care about is what happens locally. There are also processes. There is an individual complaints procedure that has been set up at the international level, although under the current system, there's an optional protocol to the convention. So you actually have to sign a different instrument to be subject to the individual complaints procedure. But that's to allow individuals or groups of individuals who have had their rights violated under the convention to go to the international system once they have not found a remedy at the local level to try to seek international redress. The U.S. has not signed any optional protocol under any other treaty recognizing an individual complaints procedure, but the U.S. is subject to an individual complaints procedure in the Inter-American Human Rights System before the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. So any of the individual complaints that we might otherwise have brought to the Committee on Persons on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, we can use the Inter-American system to bring those individual complaints while we use the international system for a periodic reporting process to help make sure that we're implementing rights at the domestic level. There's also under this treaty, and I'll stop, on a conference of states parties, which other human rights treaties don't have, but the idea of it is to make sure that states parties to this convention are learning from each other, that it's a constant process, that there are different things happening at the local level in every country of the world, and we can learn from each other. We want to learn about best practices. We want to learn about what is not working, so we can avoid doing it ourselves. And in that way, we as a world can move forward together, learning from each other. So this is an important process in which civil society can also take an active part. And we hope that the United States will ratify this treaty so it can participate in that process and work with the rest of the world to make sure that all of our legislation is as good as it can possibly be.
Thanks, Tara. We have a little time left for questions, and I see John's hand has shot up. Thomas, whoa. Okay, that was a good idea. John, do you want to ask a question? Please try and keep them brief. Huh? Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
Go to the front.
As typical
when there are big conventions or treaties, Kyoto, the Convention of the Child, probably go on, the one related to non-discrimination of women, and our country is not signed on, and there's usually been some great big group lobbying our country not to sign on, Catholic Children, Catholic Bishops, Kyoto, you know, energy producers, power companies, etc., women, probably us, all us old gray-haired guys, you know, there's always a lobby group pushing our government not to sign. Who is that group in this case? Who is pushing, I guess I asked this of Steve Hill, our government? What outside group that's probably against people with disabilities is pushing our government not to sign this convention?
Thomas, do you want to ask your question and then we'll have the panel respond?
I'm sorry, Steve. My question is to you as well.
Okay.
You're the host for today. First of all, I would like to congratulate you personally, and because you really changed the image.
Yeah.
I can say that as someone outside, because the perception of U.S. was quite different at the beginning, and after you made several very good diplomatic and good statements, which was very much appreciated from the disability community. But I must say the arguments you raised today why U.S. should not sign or ratify the convention, but the same we heard from Germany, from Sweden, from Japan, and everybody was against it in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
So in particular, Germany said, we are a federal government, we cannot do this, it's impossible, forget about it. Germany is now in the leading position to sign and ratify. So I mean, I will share that argument with you, and perhaps you should discuss with them how they have managed domestically to solve that issue. So that was one comment and question. And one comment and question also to Tara. I think you had a very good point saying that this is not just about government, it's about civil society, it's for all of us. Let me share with you that in Europe, most countries in Europe are signing and ratifying the convention, and even the European Union or Commission, we have a discussion which of the two bodies is signing is also doing it. So of the 27 countries, 28 will sign and ratify. Isn't that amazing?
Mm-hmm.
They have a campaign started by disability community saying 1 million for disability rights. They want to have 1 million signatures of people supporting the convention. And they have about 80,000 today.
Mm-hmm.
This could be an example. If you have maybe 100,000 or 200,000, I don't know what is a good figure, and showing to congressmen and people, that is an example that may be, have an impact. What about that idea? Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Thomas. Any other questions? Yes, I'm sorry, in the back.
The Constitution says that the President shall have the power, and with the advice and consent of the Senate, to make treaties. Is there any precedent across history for the Senate to advise and consent first before the President acts?
Sorry, Stephen.
Well, should we take all the questions and then
I
can research it.
let's see what the panel's got to say. Do you have any ideas?
Questions? Okay.
No, I think that's
for that particular question.
Yeah.
With respect to that question, I don't believe that has ever happened. But it's a wonderful idea, and I think that we should look closely at that language and determine whether that's a possibility. There is currently a lot of support in the Senate, which has a Democratic majority now, which has also always been one of the difficulties in getting treaties ratified with strong Republican majorities in the Senate. So this is the opportunity to do it while we have a Democratic majority. There are other treaties that the Senate is considering now, and that the majority leader has said that he will bring before the Senate as soon as the time is right, including the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. It would be wonderful to join these two treaties and try to push them together through the same process. With respect to John Lancaster's comment. I don't think that there is any single constituency that is opposed to this convention, which puts it in a very exciting position in terms of the potential of U.S. ratification of this particular treaty. The U.S. pro-life anti-abortion groups were very strongly represented in the negotiation process of this treaty, and I think that they believe that some of their interests were served and that there has been support, including in some conservative weekly journals, supporting or urging the conservative movement to back this convention. So there seems to be a convergence of movements of interest out there in support of this treaty, which makes it so important that we work creatively to create the momentum to get this ratified very quickly. The key here is to be creative and to do things differently than we have in the past. The million signatures is a wonderful idea. There are lots of other sorts of ideas that are trickling up from our local communities around the country, where we can learn from what some other groups are doing, but we need to come up with our own sorts of ideas and innovative strategies and to catch the movement. This convention is going to come into force within the year, many people saying before August. It's moving very quickly. Let's go with it.
Sure. Thanks. I agree actually with what Tara is saying. Generally speaking, thanks. On the issue of pressure groups, domestic pressure groups, frankly speaking, from the State Department perspective, and I can't speak for the other departments. The only letters that we've been receiving about the convention have been positive letters, you know, of the sort that Governor Thornburg is referring to. So I'm not aware of a domestic constituency that's, as is the case with respect to some of the other conventions, is in a blocking position. Thomas, thank you very much for your kind words, and it's a pleasure to work closely with your organization also, and I relied on you and a lot of others for diplomatic advice as a newcomer, a relative latecomer to the process. I appreciated it. You know, in terms of what different countries do to get themselves ready to sign treaties, et cetera, it does tend to be different, but we do have a legal dialogue with our European partners, also with Canada and Australia and the like. And I would like to discuss with them how they handled some of these federalism issues. But you know, in a lot of the European constitutions, international law has a different position. But it is something definitely worth following up on. And then on the Senate practice, I wouldn't want to speak outside of the human rights treaty area because, frankly, that's the one I'm most familiar with. But the procedure is always for the president to submit the treaty to Congress. I'm not sure what that means for people who might want to engage with the Senate or the rest of Congress, but that's what the procedure is to submit the package to the Senate.
Thank you, Steve. I think this brings us to an end. Thank you very much. I think this has been a very useful panel looking at the process, the principles, and the prospects, and hopefully will give us food for thought throughout the rest of the day. So thank you very much for your attention.